This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Hoosier History. From local history journals and books from across the Hoosier State, you'll learn the stories of the people and events that have shaped our present. For the next 60 minutes, it's Hoosier History, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Hoosier History, and I'm your reader, Pat, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from a variety of publications about Indiana history. And now I'll begin with We Do History. It's so fun. September is National Sewing Month. This is written September 29, 2025. Copyright 2025, Indiana Historical Society. I have gone through many crafting phases in my life, including embroidery, knitting, and sewing. It had been about 20 years since I last made any clothing for myself until last month. Above, there's a photo. You can see a portion of two of the skirts I've sewn recently, both created using simplicity patterns. The thing I love best about making my own skirts is the vast array of fabric out there, so your wardrobe becomes unique to you. I initially learned to sew in home economics in junior high school, but didn't make any clothing for myself until graduate school. Over the years, many young people have learned to sew with the help of teachers. Above there's a photo of two groups of high school students and one group of younger girls at a community center learning the art of sewing by hand or machine. While the original purpose of National Sewing Month, a celebration day initiated by Ronald Reagan, focuses on home sewists, those who end up working in the alteration work, garment factories, and other industrial sewing jobs often get their first taste of the trade at home or school. Without that background, they would likely not be successfully employed in the field. The shops featured here are just a few of the many departments or factories that did the important work of sewing in Indiana. One photo shows seamstresses and tailors at L.S. Ayers, Indianapolis, circa 1890. Lewis Meyer Company garment workers, Indianapolis, circa 1909. Miss Newhart and fellow employees at Indiana Rayon Company, Terre Haute, 1945. Often men took sewing projects, even going into tailoring. Above are groups of men working on various tailoring projects, soldiers, tailors, and students alike working in or learning the trade. And there's photos of soldiers doing some tailoring, circa 1890s, Regal's Tailoring Shop, Whitley County, 1911, Crispus Attucks Tailoring Class, Indianapolis, circa 1940. Hopefully, you can join me in celebrating National Sewing Month through some home sewing projects of your own. Whether you need new curtains or want to give your wardrobe a funky pop, grab your sewing supplies and have fun. For more National Day Calendar Month celebration blogs and more, please visit the IHS blog site. This was written by Amy Vidra, the Director of Reference Services. As an avid reader, she reads as many books as possible annually. All books count, audio, e, and print. The next article is Wake Up and Smell the September Celebration Day. This is written September 25th, 2025. September brings us many varieties of celebration days, but I was on the hunt for one that really spoke to me. I found it. September 29th is National Coffee Day. Whether you are a coffee aficionado, a run-of-the-mill enjoyer of, or hate it with a passion, there's no denying that coffee is a staple for many Americans. I came to love coffee later in my life, my 40s. Prior to that, coffee was only enjoyed on occasion in the form of an iced or blended coffee beverage that was more flavoring and fillers than coffee. Truly introduced to the beverage in its natural state by my husband, I now enjoy an almost daily cup or two of Joe. Enjoy the journey through some of her imagery featuring coffee. And there's a photo, an ad card for Morning Joy Coffee, circa 1890, ad card front and back for Banner Coffee, circa 1890. I will not delve into the history of coffee production. However, I would like to highlight some of the advertising that goes into preparing and making available the beans for the beverage for purchase. A couple of examples from our collection are some advertising cards. First, we have a lovely dog on a rocking chair highlighting Morning Joy Coffee. This 1890s card features a New Orleans brand sold widely in Indiana groceries. Banner Coffee, produced by the Indiana Coffee Company in the 1890s, included, quote, a beautiful picture card in every package, end quote, such as the one shown. The image has nothing to do with coffee, but allowed the purchaser a pretty memento with their important purchase. Another advertising tactic was to show someone enjoying the drink. Above in the photo, model Vivian Silvers sips Farmer's Pride Coffee in 1930. Farmer's Pride was an offshoot brand under the Holman and Company of Terre Haute, probably best known for their Clabber Girl products. Obviously, one of the biggest selling points for coffee is drinking it. Coffee's abundance and easy access to a supply haven't always been a given. During the Civil War, coffee was one of those commodities much sought after by the soldiers. Shown here are a few drawings and photos from the time that highlights the camaraderie shared over a campfire, brewing some up, and the importance of finding others with a supply that may be willing to trade you for some. Their letters home included below also showed their need, use, and the cost of the commodity. And there's a photo of Civil War letters of James H. Henderson, December 1862, Samuel E. Sneer, June 1863, James M. Chamberlain, July 1865. So many other coffee-related materials can be found in our digital collection. I encourage you to take a peek and see if any of them stand out to you. You'll find people enjoying the hot beverage at parties, political events, and more, as well as others mentioning the drink in their letters home, and so much more. Please check out our other blogs this month and beyond on the IHS blog site. I'm off to enjoy another cup of Joe for the day. That was written by Amy Vedra. The next article is Bringing Collections to Life with Unboxed. This was written September 15, 2025. Unboxed is a YouTube video series produced by the Indiana Historical Society that highlights our archival collections and gives voice to Indiana stories. These are short, 3 to 5 minute videos that are perfect for the classroom or the casual history buff. The series gives an inside look at special collections and how they're stored in our archives. Work on the series started just about 1 year ago, so I thought I'd share how the series came to be. In the summer of 2024, I was tasked with designing a video series to highlight the IHS collections, with practically full creative control over the process. As a big fan of documentaries and YouTube video essays, I was both excited and nervous to take on the project. Equipped with my childhood experience with Windows 2009 Movie Maker, I first explored the tools needed to develop a web series. Lucky for me, the IHS staff is full of talented people who walked me through using recording equipment, storyboarding, and video editing. Videos start with a large yellow sticky note on my office wall filled with topic ideas sourced from IHS staff and my own research rabbit holes. Those ideas are then taken back to the stacks, where the majority of the Society's collections are stored. Here I have the absolute pleasure of searching through the shelves with the lovely Meyer Gurewitz, Director of Collections Management at IHS. This is where some of the real magic happens. While we often come in with a plan of what to pull and examine, we often find the best materials by accident, simply by opening a box. Over the past year, we have showcased comics on AIDS, bankers in the Russian Revolution, Indiana State Parks, car headlight production, and more. A personal favorite of mine is the story of Nurse Safe Sex, a public health activist and drag queen in Indianapolis. Ken King designed the character as a way to spread safety information on the looming AIDS crisis and to highlight resources in central Indiana. King's story is one of grassroots activism and a strong love of community that I love to share whenever possible. Besides sharing unique stories, the Unbox series is also a fantastic way to showcase the works of our library and archive staff. Unboxed viewers have gotten glimpses into collections in cold storage, how processing new collections works, how library staff does research on collections, and where the public can view these collections themselves. While many may be familiar with collections on display, few know that the vast majority of IHS collections are in the archives, waiting for researchers and staff alike to use. Unboxed not only shares amazing Hoosier stories, but also provides an inside look on how our state's history is preserved. You can view the Unboxed series on the IHS YouTube channel. This was written by Jessica Balloun, an education and engagement specialist at the Indiana Historical Society. She is connoisseur of queer and cemetery history, as well as a proud parent of two adorable cats. Now I'll be reading from Indiana Historical Society In Perspective, September-October 2025, copyright 2025, Indiana Historical Society Press. And we'll start with a letter from Jody Blankenship, President and CEO. Last month, the Indiana Historical Society, and many of us personally, lost a remarkable Hoosier with the passing of Patty Curran. The obituary on the following page outlines her many contributions across personal, professional, civic, and philanthropic spheres. But those words, as meaningful as they are, can only begin to capture the vibrant spirit, sharp intellect, and generous heart that defined Patty. She was one of those rare individuals who leave a lasting imprint on everyone they meet. Many of us will be telling Patty stories for years to come. I'm sure you have at least one of your own. Patty's passing has me thinking about legacy. Who will step into the shoes of leaders like her? Who will take up the mantle of service, vision, and commitment that she carried so gracefully? And perhaps most importantly, how do we ensure that the wisdom, lessons, and values Patty embodied are passed on, not just remembered, but lived? Patty and her peers built and strengthened institutions, causes, and communities that will outlast them. These are gifts to all of us, gifts built through dedication, collaboration, and deep belief in the power of collective effort. Patty understood that these legacies don't sustain themselves. They required continued care, resources, and resolve. We're living through a time of great change, culturally, socially, politically. History reminds us that change is nothing new, but it also reminds us of the importance of grounding ourselves in the enduring lessons of those who came before us. I hope we won't treat the contributions of people like Patty Curran as relics of the past, but rather as guideposts for the future. Let's honor Patty not just with our memories, but with our actions. Let's carry her work forward. Thank you, Patty. And now here's the obituary for Patricia D. Curran, 1942 to 2025. IHS has lost one of its most ardent supporters and volunteers, Patricia D. Curran, longtime IHS trustee and former IHS Board of Trustees chair, who passed away on July 6, 2025. Born in Syracuse, New York, on May 31, 1942, Patty attended Solvay High School and spent her summers enjoying the beautiful scenery of Scantnels Lake and the Finger Lakes region in central New York. She attended Nazareth College, where she received a Bachelor of Science in the field of chemistry. After college, she began her career as a chemist. Patty married William Bill Curran in September 1966, whom she met on a blind date and always said it was love at first sight. Bill and Patty remained happily married until his death in June 2015. As an active member of the Syracuse community, Patty served on several boards and volunteered for many organizations. Once her children were school age, she decided to re-enter the workforce, working first as an independent contractor, and then in company roles for the Carlyle Collection, which she grew into a thriving business. In 1986, the family moved to Indianapolis. In 1991, Patty left the Carlisle Collection to be part of a startup company called the Worth Collection LTD, where she was the Executive Vice President of Operations and became a mentor to many young women and men through the years. Patty was a driving force and tireless engine for IHS's success. She first devoted her time to IHS in 1999 as part of the grand opening committee for what is now known as the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. Among other duties, she organized the parade of floats along the canal as part of the opening weekend festivities. In 2003, Patty joined the IHS Board of Trustees and began her work with the development committee, first as a member, then as chair. She helped start the Council of 1816, which now boasts more than 300 supporters. She also brought her keen style and event expertise to her work as chair of the Living Legends Steering Committee, which surpassed its fundraising goal each year of her involvement. Her guidance has helped cement its reputation as one of the best-run and most enjoyable fundraising events in the state. Patty's legacy includes the annual Festival of Trees. Over the past decade, this signature event has exponentially grown in terms of both scope and visitation, making the History Center a must-see during the holidays. As an active member of the Indianapolis community, Patty also served organizations like the Indianapolis Opera, the Junior League of Indianapolis, the Italian Heritage Society, the Progressive Club of Indianapolis, Marion University, and the Edeljord Museum. A devout Catholic, Patty also volunteered for St. Luke Catholic Church. Those who knew Patty would say she was kind, generous, fun to be around, and someone who always encouraged people to be their best selves. Now we're switching to Hoosier Folk Legends by Ronald L. Baker, copyright 1982 by Ronald L. Baker. Our next chapter is Folk Doctors. Doc Cox found cure for cancer. Old Doc Cox, mostly Indian he was, lived down south of Sullivan a ways. He was one of these herb doctors, used all kinds of herbs, such as ginseng and plantain and a whole raft of other herbs. Old Doc Cox was never a graduate of any highfalutin school of medicine. Still, he could cure more diseases than any 10 other doctors. American Medical Association tried to shut him down for many years. That's 'cause he knew more medicine than they did. Well, anyway, old Doc found himself a cure for cancer. That's when they really did start to try to shut him down. A company over in Indianapolis sent a man over to check on him. They're one of the largest drug makers of the world. They even offered $50,000 cold cash, mind you, for his remedy for cancer killing. So they persecuted and prosecuted him for practicing medicine without a license. Sent Doc up to Michigan City Prison. Old Doc died up in prison and never did tell them drug companies the secrets so they could make a fortune off of poor folks. It's all right, though. Granny B knows. The next one is Dr. Wheat. Dr. Wheat, an herb doctor, lived in Coxville. So, wait a minute, he had an office at the entrance of the Coxville-covered bridge, and Dad said he could remember when people used to line their Model Ts up and down the road waiting to get in to see him. Members of his family sold tickets to these people to see the doctor. He was so famous he was invited to St. Louis to lecture, and he walked there gathering herbs on the way. When he got to St. Louis, he lectured using the herbs he had gathered along the way. He had a girl which jilted him, and being a pretty eccentric man, he took the buggy that he used to court her apart and reassembled it in his living room, where it remained for the rest of his life. He spent very little of his money and usually hid it in places around his home. As late as 1952, I believe, people have been finding sums of money around Coxville that he buried. The next one is Dr. Green. Dr. Green was a queer man. He never visited a patient on foot, sometimes riding his horse into the cabin itself before dismounting. He wore a long overcoat the year around and carried a hoe to gather the herbs and roots he used in his treatments. He had many superstitions, one of which was that the patient must not be moved from the original direction nor the bed moved. He carried a piece of charcoal in his pockets and he drew a ring around the entire bed to keep off more spirits, and one around each leg to prove to himself the bed was untouched. Perhaps his greatest claim to fame was Silver Dollar Jim. Jim, a storekeeper, had received a blow from an iron weight, which had caused a slight skull fracture. Dr. Green was called, and he proclaimed the devil to come out of that there head, dang ye. With no result, but more severe fits, he decided upon a rare procedure. He sent a boy to his home to get a silver dollar. Spirit needed silver, he said. He then removed some of the bone, and thus relieving the pressure, the fits left the patient. He inserted the silver dollar, and Jim went 60 years more with the money in his skull. Many of the older residents remember the thrill of touching the spirit's silver spot on the head of Silver Dollar Jim. The next chapter is Outlaws. The first story is Jesse James's hideout in Jay County. I don't know if I ever told you this before, but Jesse James and his brothers used to hide out in my grandpa's hayloft down near the Ohio line in Jay County, Indiana. You see, Jesse's mother was a cousin to the Steeds, and my grandma's name was Steed, and she lived in Osgood, Indiana. Jesse James used to come through quite often on one of his rampages and have to lay low for a while. I've heard tell Jesse wasn't near as bad as they said he was. It's true he did steal from the rich and give to the poor, but he was lots of times blamed for stealing he didn't do. The next story is Frank Reno. Where old man Everhart lives, now this friend of mine, this Mrs. Reeves, she was an able, and she was born and raised out there, and said that Frank Reno was a good man. He was just like the sheep-killing dog. He just caught wool in his teeth. But he was a good-hearted man, and she said that when any of her brothers was born, why, they made you then, they didn't get you up to walk around the next day. They made you lay in bed 11 days and wouldn't comb your hair, and they wouldn't let you sweep under the bed, nor would they allow anybody to sweep under and change your bed. Had to lay right there in that gook. Bad luck to move you. For 9 days you're like that. Anyways, and she said her mother was in bed with one of her brothers. I forgot now which one she said it was. And their house got a fire and burnt. And they carried her out on a bed and carried her into the barn loft. And she said that they didn't have my land, they didn't have no insurance or anything at all about it. She said that when Frank Reno, he was gone and he happened to come back, he heard about it by hook or crook, you know, no telephones, no nothing. And he came back, and she said he come down there in the barn and just turned his pockets. They was neighbors there. He turned his wrong side out and gave her dad, old man Abel, every dime he had. And she said, Marguerite, it was rolls and skadoodles of money. And now, take this and build you a house. And she said with what they could salvage, planks and stuff out of the river, and what Frank Reno give 'em, that house right where Bud's dad lives is the house, built with Reno money. The next story is Al Capone's country home near Chesterton. As you drive up Indian Boundary Road near Chesterton, Indiana, you cross a bridge and go through a grove of trees, and on the right is an estate called Palomera Farms, and it's a large plantation, kind of like a big manor and a group of caretakers' buildings set on a lake. The grounds are cornfields and woods, and nobody lives there except for a caretaker. At one time, this was Al Capone's country home, a place where he and the syndicate could hide out and carry out their dirty dealings. And they said several of Al's boys were picked up here and arrested during a big raid on the place at the end of Al's reign. They say that the syndicate still owns the place because people come and go, but nobody knows where they're from, and the farm is not being used to grow crops. Here's Al Capone's hideout near Edwardsport. Al Capone had a hideaway in the river bottoms in the southern part of the state, west of a little town on Highway 67 called Edwardsport. This hideaway was built as a double corn crib out in the commons, where it wasn't likely anyone would happen to be around. The corn would be in the cribs on each side, but in the middle of the crib or the driveway was two rooms. One was for his automobile, and the other was for Al's comfort while dodging the police. It has been said that Al's places of hiding were very plush and elaborate and had all the facilities that there could be this far out in the country. People nearby knew what the corn crib was really for, and out of their own good judgment for their safety, would not relay the information to the police. This is supposed to be one of Capone's hideaways that was never bothered. The next story is John Dillinger, Hoosier Robin Hood. Collector, you mean Dillinger was sort of a Robin Hood? Do you mean by that Dillinger gave to the poor? Informant, that's right. He gave me money more than once, $10 at a time, and that was when $10 was something hard to latch onto. Hell yes, he used to give me $10 or so, and he'd say, here, kid, go have yourself a good time. He was a hell of a nice guy, John Dillinger, and so was Harry Pierpoint and Babyface Nelson. Why, they used to give away whiskey to us kids, you know that? They was the nicest fellas. They used to work in people's gardens, and once I saw Pierpont and Babyface Nelson clearing land for one of my neighbors. Collector, what do you think about the fact that Dillinger stole money and perhaps killed people? Informant, Johnny got a real raw deal when he was real young, and you know how the law operates. Well, times were rough and money was tight, real tight, and Dillinger wanted money fast. But he was real nice, not selfish like most. He'd give you the shirt off your back, but he'd steal your money. The next story is Dillinger robs the Rockville Bank. About the only thing I can tell you is I was here that day that it happened, but I didn't pay any attention to it, 'cause there wasn't much to it, see? He didn't get it done, see? He said this was one place he failed, see? And he walked in there, and they didn't have any alarm down there or nothing. Had a hole in the wall back there, and a feller with a shotgun laying back there, laying right there aside of it. Course, I knew the shotgun was there because I worked as a plumber. And when he came in down there, they found out the fellow was down there, see? And this fellow picked up the scatter gun, a barrel about that long, about 2 feet, and pointed it at them and told them either get out or there'll be hell to pay. Then they pulled their guns and backed out, and that was the end of it. That's all there was to it. He always said that was the only one he ever failed at. I can't remember when it was. It just slips my mind. The next story is Belle Gunness. There is a farm in LaPorte on McClung Road where a woman named Belle Gunness lived. It was about 50 years ago because I can remember my folks telling about her. She was a very large woman, big and strong and not nice looking at all. She would advertise in out-of-state newspapers for male companions. She said she was lonely. Since she owned this 80-acre farm, one of the stipulations in the ad was that the man have some money. They would come, she would take their money and kill them. When she was found out and they started digging on the farm, they found 17 bodies. They were all cut up and put in gunny sacks. Belle had a daughter that graduated from high school in LaPorte and was supposedly sent off to college. But no one ever saw her after that. They think that one of the bodies that they dug up was her daughter. The way she was found out was a brother of one of the victims was suspicious because he never heard from his brother after he left for Indiana. So he came to LaPorte to find him. The house on the farm burned down, and the body of a woman was found in the ashes. But a local dentist said it wasn't Belle. The bridge work of the body they found was not that of Belle Gunness. It is thought that she killed someone and planted the body in the house and set fire to it. It was believed, but never proven, that a local attorney, and possibly even the sheriff, helped her escape for money. The neighbor said that she was a very good-hearted person and did a lot for other people. It was the neighbor lady who felt later that she had done something to the daughter. I don't think she ever married any of the men. Now we're switching to Beyond Books, Allen County's Public Library History, 1895 to 1995 by Don Slater Putt. Copyright 1995, Allen County Public Library. And we're continuing with the Talking Book Service. In January 1981, when the library's new edition opened, Talking Books was located just around the corner from Young Adult Services in the new wing. A newspaper article explained the service, quote, as part of the National Library Service for the blind and physically handicapped, Talking Books provides a vast array of recorded material on discs and tape cassettes to people who cannot use printed material, end quote. Featured were classics, bestsellers, and even current magazines. The library also supplied the tape and record playing machinery necessary to listen to the Talking Books materials. A low-vision magnifying device was available for public use. It magnified printed images to 40 times their original size. The library planned to acquire additional equipment for the blind and other print handicapped people as computer and television technology progressed. Although the Talking Book service circulated most of its materials through the mail, some of its patrons visited the library for Talking Book supplies. In all, 677 patrons participated in the Talking Books program in 1981, and 32,529 Talking Books were circulated. A wide cross-section of fiction and nonfiction was available, including 44 magazine titles, 10,000 records of recorded books, and 8,000 cassette tapes of recorded books. Patrons could choose books and magazines from the department's indices without visiting the library, or indicate their favorite genres and allow staff members to choose the materials for them. The Talking Books area occupied 2,500 square feet in the addition to the main library. The Allen County Public Library Talking Books Service acted as a sub-regional library for Steuben, Noble, DeKalb, Whitley, Allen, Huntington, Wells, and Adams counties. In 1981, Isabel Otter was manager. In January 1982, local World Book Encyclopedia sales agents donated a Talking World Book, the first and only encyclopedia recorded on tape to date, to the library. It was housed in the Talking Books area. By May of that year, the library was planning for a computer that quote-unquote read books with a mechanical voice, which was expected to be in place within 6 to 8 weeks. The device was capable of scanning most types of print and speaking the contents to library patrons with sight impairments. The Kurzweil reading machine arrived in November and was the second in Indiana. Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis had the first. By the time of its arrival, 35 people had expressed interest in using the Kurzweil machine. It was in 1983 that the Talking Books Service became part of the Reader Services Department. Patrons in 8 surrounding counties who were blind or physically handicapped continued to receive materials through this service. Available were recorded books, large print books, and a Pelco magnifying machine. In 1987, Talking Books functions were again moved from a public to a non-public area. Library Director Jeffrey Krall said the reasoning behind the move of Talking Books to the basement was that patrons of this service received tapes and records through the mail rather by visiting the library. Marilyn Allmendinger, Talking Books clerk, logged nearly 400 miles in 1990, traveling around the area speaking about the service. She is the clerk of the Reader Services Department and remains the contact for Talking Books. The next chapter is television services. In 1979, the Allen County Public Library drafted an agreement with Citizens Cable of Fort Wayne and the Citizens Council for Program Development for a tentative plan to house cable television public access facilities in the library's new addition, which was under construction. Free airtime would be available on the channel for programs produced by groups or individuals in the community. In 1980, the library board opened the bidding process for equipment for the television studio to be housed in the library addition. The board awarded a $124,606 contract for video studio equipment to Thalner Electronics Laboratory of Ann Arbor, Michigan in August 1980. A local newspaper article described the television studio facilities in January 1981. They included a studio, control room, and offices, and were known as the Telecommunications Center. Quote, a new library service, the Telecommunications Center, is the focal point for public access television in Fort Wayne and Allen County. In cooperation with Fort Wayne Cablevision and the Citizens Council for Program Development, the library provides the Telecommunications Center as a medium through which individuals and groups can communicate with the entire community, end quote. A goal of the center was to provide television programs of public interest as a part of the library's continuing service to the community. These programs would represent a wide variety of viewer interest, ranging from documentaries on local history to programs for children. Among the services of the new department were training in the use of video equipment and assistance in the production of shows. Equipment training sessions began in February 1981. The television shows produced ultimately were broadcast on cable Channel 10. The library also planned to use Channel 10 for advertisement and coverage of its programs and services, beginning with live coverage of the grand opening and dedication ceremonies of the library addition on January 18, 1981. Pamela Bieri was public access coordinator at the center's opening. The opening of the telecommunications center was not the first time the public library had become involved in producing television programs, however. The facility was part of the first Citizen Council for Program Development in 1972. It produced more than 600 programs, from training tapes to documentary work, to films of the historical events from 1972 to 1980. These were shown at video concerts at the library, over cable systems in the surrounding area, and occasionally as clips on the local news networks. However, no local public access cable channel existed until 1981. One of the first programs broadcast on Channel 10 was a series of live, balanced, and informed discussions on current and continuing issues facing the Fort Wayne and Allen County community that was produced by Theater for Ideas. Other early programs planned included One-on-One in Fort Wayne, an interview program, Story Hours for Children, and Book Talk, a program on new additions to the library and how they were chosen. Public service announcements were broadcast late at night and early in the morning. Another early programming idea was the possibility of televising Fort Wayne City Council sessions, but Mayor Winfield Moses was against this plan. He told reporters that he worried that the heavily Republican Library Board of Directors would wield political influence over shows carried on Channel 10. Ben Eisbart, chairman of the City Council's Cable Television Committee, disagreed. He noted that the library had hired professionals trained in cable television to conduct public access work, and that he did not believe their coverage would be biased. Eventually, the idea was scrapped because of council members' questions about the appropriateness of a governmental entity, the library, bidding against private companies for the contract for televising the meetings. In 1981, the first year of the Television Services Department, the library underwent a strategic planning process for its next several years. The resulting plan called for an increase in the amount of original programming broadcast on Channel 10. That year, 444 public access programs were produced. From the beginning, the library had big plans for Channel 10 and the Television Services Department. Library Director Rick J. Ashton looked into the future early in the department's history to predict that, although its initial purpose was to provide an extra medium for information and entertainment, the cable system might someday become a two-way link with home computer systems. In January 1982, children from two local schools were involved in the production of television programs in conjunction with the Television Services Department. A seventh-grade English class at Canterbury School produced its own commercials, while Memorial Park Magnet School also was beginning a production. Channel 10 employees provided some hints and some technical training on the use of the equipment, but the children did the work themselves. Since most high school students had access to video studios in their schools, it was the department's goal to concentrate on younger children. The students' productions were aired during after-school hours. The same month, a local newspaper featured an article on four 12-year-old students who were producing their own science fiction television program, filmed with $5,000 worth of equipment borrowed from the Allen County Public Library's Telecommunications Center. Bob Irie of the Telecommunications Center told the reporter that he knew of only two other places, Bloomington, Indiana, and a town near Madison, Wisconsin, where children could produce their own shows. The children did all of the work themselves, except the addition of credits and the editing of the films, both of which were done by staff with the children's supervision. Since the beginning of its existence, the Television Services Department has been one of the most popular areas of the library for volunteers to work. In the fall of 1982, however, a public controversy developed when several volunteers were asked to leave and not return. The situation began when Telecommunications Center Secretary Pat Schmidt was fired. Several Channel 10 volunteers testified in Schmidt's behalf at her state employment compensation hearing, saying that, quote, an atmosphere of antagonism, favoritism, and intention, end quote, existed at the Telecommunications Center, and they were accused of interfering in library personnel business. A local newspaper columnist described the situation in a column titled, Telling the Truth Gets Costly. Although it undoubtedly was an uncomfortable period for the volunteers and library staff members involved, the controversy did not discourage the steady stream of volunteers to Television Services. By January 1984, about 100 volunteers worked regularly in the Public Access Television studio. In December 1982, the department hosted a workshop on video camera techniques for potential volunteers, who were needed to assist in the production of specials for Channel 10. Participants were asked to pay a $5 registration fee, which was refunded upon completion of the workshop. Once a training workshop was completed, participants could take video equipment from the library and use it for field work. Workshops were available on an ongoing basis. In 1982, 655 television programs were generated and broadcast over Channel 10. This was a 48% increase over 1981. Beginning in January 1983, the main library began opening for Sunday hours. One of two exceptions to this new schedule was the Telecommunications Center. However, the department continued its services to the community during the week. In April 1983, Channel 10 broadcast religious shows, fine arts programs, and shows on business, community affairs, physical fitness, and exercise. Quote, here was an opportunity for the butcher, the baker, the supermart checkout to be on television to read poems, act in plays, sing songs, sermonize, politicize, all without the strict censorship of commercial television, end quote. In 1983, 687 public access television programs were produced. In 1985, the number climbed to 943. In 1986, to 1,164. In 1988, it was 854, and in 1989, it was 879. In 1991, library staff members began the process of creating another strategic plan for the following 5 years. Strategies in this plan involving the Television Services Department included increasing the use of Channel 10 to promote library resources, services, and programs, and securing funding from appropriate non-library sources to support the operation of public access and educational access television channels. Finances have been a challenge for this department in the early 1990s. In February 1993, to ease the financial strain, it was again suggested that Channel 10 televise Fort Wayne City Council meetings, for which the city would pay $18,000 to $20,000 per year. A second project being launched at the same time was a grant proposal to the Cable Television Program Advisory Committee, CTPAC, for money to replace equipment, provide new equipment, and fund a staff position. In the past, CTPAC had funded equipment, but not staff salaries. Some of the programming broadcast on Channel 10 since the beginning of its second decade has included a children's services puppet show, French news programs, the Three Rivers Festival Parade, a public service announcement about the library's new automated catalog, and a program on criminal violence sponsored by the National Issues Forum. Rick Hayes became manager of Public Access Channel 10 in 1987. Ross Rowe had been the previous manager of Channel 10, followed by Marie Schroeder as acting manager. In the fall of 1987, the library took over management of a second television channel, Educational Access Channel 20, which went on the air in January 1988. According to Hayes, Channel 20 had had no local programming in the 7 years prior to its acquisition by the library. It was dedicated to providing educational programming for children in kindergarten through 12th grade. Teachers and students were trained by television services employees to produce their own programs, which were aired in addition to imported, high-quality educational programming. The operation of the channel has been returned to Fort Wayne Community Schools. Television services staff members and community producers have earned numerous awards, some of them national, for their efforts in the production of television programs. The next chapter is young adult services. As early as the 1920s, older children had an area of the children's room where they could look at books for their age group, or at periodicals such as Youth's Companion, St. Nicholas, Popular Mechanics, Boys' Life, and Popular Science Monthly. Beginning in 1926, a librarian was scheduled in the adult stacks to help older boys and girls select books. Staff members also gave library instruction to 7th and 8th grade students in the local public schools at this time. These were the beginnings of what would be the intermediate, high school, or ultimately the young adults' room. By the early 1950s, students were visiting the library in larger numbers as teachers began to demand more outside work. Adult patronage began to diminish slightly in the face of the teenage onslaught in the reference area, and the library's administration saw, quote, the desirability of segregating the high school students, end quote. A large room on the east side of the main library's first floor was set aside particularly for teenagers and named the Young Adults Room by local students to indicate that the room was for serious study and not social activity. The Young Adults Room officially opened February 25, 1952, with the goal of providing material and services to area middle and high school students. An electric sign in the form of a red arrow directed young adults to their room, comfortable, inviting quarters where they could, quote, read, study, or just browse without fear of disturbing other adult patrons, end quote. The room's book collection was based on the reading lists of the city public and parochial schools, combined with current teenage reading interests. Topics included science fiction, romances, travel stories, adventures, biographies, mechanics, and handicrafts. The room also had a reference collection, and staff members were available to answer reference questions. From its beginning, the department included information on colleges and their educational requirements, vocational schools, careers, and trades. The Young Adults Room was open Monday through Friday from 1 to 9 p.m. and Saturday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Subscriptions to various magazines were maintained, and the room had collections of the local high school's newspapers. A bulletin board was available for the posting of notices of high school events. Use of the Young Adults Room increased through the mid-1950s. In 1956, the room saw an increase of 30% in pamphlet use, 200% in clipping use, and 300% in the use of the picture collection. The room's main features in 1961 were the reference books and periodicals that demand had indicated were most needed by students, titles from the local school's English and Latin reading lists, and vocational guidance information. In 1961, the Young Adults Room was open during the school year only. Students' needs were met by other departments during the summer. By November 1963, teenagers were a rapidly growing group of library patrons. The Young Adults Room seated about 150 and was usually full. Plans for the new main library building were underway, and in the new building, the Young Adults Room would be the largest of all rooms. Seating would be doubled to 300 capacity. In that busy year of 1963, staff members answered 7,952 questions in the Young Adults Room. This number increased to 8,278 in 1964 and decreased somewhat to 7,618 in 1965. In 1967, reference questions answered were back up to 8,466. Teenage hijinks in 1965 apparently included cavorting barefooted through the library. The library board in July ruled that, quote, high school students must wear shoes and socks when using the facilities of the Fort Wayne Public Library, end quote. Head librarian Fred Reynolds had reported, quote, a little trouble this summer in the shoe and sock department, end quote, and had asked the board for approval to give library security officers the authority to tell young people to keep their shoes and socks on while in the building. During the mid-1960s, while the new main library building was being constructed, the Young Adults Room was located in the Purdue Building at the corner of Jefferson Boulevard and Bar Street, along with many other main library functions. The Young Adults area was housed in the building's former ballroom, where longtime Young Adult Services manager Betty Henning later remembered, quote, students danced their way through Hemingway and Hawthorne, end quote. Some of the department's books, including Shakespeare, were shelved on the ballroom stage. The room's collection of the time was partially formed in conjunction with school reading lists. During the 1960s, librarians began supplying questions for a local radio quiz show called Hi Quiz. Robert H. Vegler, assistant director, led Young Adults Room activities with the help of Peter Olvenick until 1967, when head librarian Fred Reynolds named Betty Henning the first official manager of the Young Adults Room. She had been successful in campaigning with four directors and various library boards to get the special area for young adults. In April 1968, the new main library was not yet open. The Young Adults Room, still located in the Purdue Building, sponsored a National Library Week essay contest for 7th through 12th graders with the theme, What I Expect of My Library. The best local entry was to advance to the state contest. The winning entry at the state level would win $100, while the second place entry would win $20. The Young Adults Room of the late 1960s was, quote, not an area containing all material for the high school age library user. Rather, it was a space set aside as a study room, end quote. It did house standard reference books, but beyond those, young readers requested material from the main collection which was brought to them, or they were taken to the material. The goal, or at least the result of this system, was that it concentrated young adults' use of the library into one area, where these young patrons would not disturb other library users. A consultant's report prior to the opening of the new main library building in 1968 suggested that this system put an unnecessary burden on staff and added that, quote, with the intensive literature use now required, it is not possible to serve high school students without access to material which a decade ago would have been considered college level, end quote. Well, that's all the time we have for today. We'll continue this book next time. This has been Pat with Hoosier History. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.